Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another webcast from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. The reason for changing the web address from blogtalkradio.com Water Fuel Museum to blogtalkradio.com Water Fuel 2007 is because Blog Talk Radio does not maintain in the archives for the listening audience more than 5 shows, and previous shows that may have very valuable information in them are deleted with each additional show that's added. So I felt that it's time to move on to another Blog Talk Radio show so that the previous information, which is really of great value to people interested in pursuing water fuel technology, so that can remain on their site for a number of months and not be erased or put into an archive that is not accessible to the public. So today we have a special guest that I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing. His name is Dale Pond. He is an author, a lecturer, and a developer of technology having to do with vibratory sympathetic, or rather sympathetic vibratory physics. Let's see if Dale isn't with us and let him explain all this to us. Hello, Dale, are you there? Oh, just one second here. Let's try that. Hello, Dale. Try it again. Let's see, something has happened. Maybe Dale may need to call in again. Yeah, let's ask Dale to call in again and see if we can't get him on the line here. It looks like I may have actually hung up on him, so let's see if he doesn't call back in for us. While we're waiting, I will mention that Dale is probably the leading expert on the work of John Worrell Keeley, who was a Pennsylvania inventor from the 1800s, who interested himself in the effects of sound on matter. And so we could call him an acoustic researcher. Okay, now let's see if we don't have Dale with us here. Hello, Dale.
Yes, James.
Sorry, I'm not much of a studio technician. It seems that I hung up on you.
Oh, all right.
I'm getting used to the system. Hopefully that won't happen again. I'd like to welcome you to our program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, I'm looking at a copy of your book, Universal Laws Never Before Revealed, Keeley's Secrets. And it goes on to say under the title, Understanding and Using the Science of Sympathetic Vibration. So I would take it that this is one of your most comprehensive works on this technology of using sound or sympathetic vibration as a means of accomplishing work, I suppose we would say?
That book was first published in 1994.
Okay, so it goes back, what, 13 years?
Yeah, so it was pretty much up to date at that time, but we've pushed the envelope quite a bit since then.
Okay, well, why don't we start with your background? Why don't you tell our listeners who you are, where you're from, when you got interested in alternative energy, and so on.
Well, I got a lot of history. I'm not going to go into all of that. We don't have time for that. But I'm in La Junta, Colorado right now, and we have a research center set up here for investigating various kinds of free energy physics, and most specifically the physics of sound and vibration. And
but you're not limited to that. You do delve into other technologies.
Right. We delve into quite a few things.
Okay. Now, you told me an interesting story about how you first got interested in alternative energy technology, and it was an experience of anger at the utility companies. And I think several other people have repeated similar stories to me. Perhaps you could briefly recap what happened.
Well, I don't know that it was anger, but it certainly was frustration at those people. They're holding all the cards. I bought 40 acres, and I wanted to put power onto it. The nearest power pole was about 1,500 feet away. You could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had them come out and look at it, and these two guys said, well, it'll cost you $26,000. And in 1980, that was quite a bit of money. And I says, well, what if I got the poles? I said, still cost $26,000. Well, what if I got the poles and I put them in myself? and said, wouldn't make any difference, still $26,000.
And this is for them to charge you for electricity.
Yeah, they would charge me after we got it in place.
Yeah, so they don't want you as a customer bad enough to offer you a line to your house, huh?
Right. Well, since then, I found out that there's a nationwide strategy to hinder and make difficult anybody trying to move out of the cities. There's this worldwide agenda. It's called Agenda 21. They're trying to get everybody into the cities. And so as far back as 1980, they were putting roadblocks in front of people, you know, trying to keep them in the cities.
So you actually subscribe to a conspiracy theory that they want people living in what amounts to a concentration camp or something?
I didn't say concentration camp. I said city.
No, that's what I thought of, though. You get all these people grouped together in these conditions, and you basically have them in a camp-like setting. At least that's what I see happening in America, because the people living in the cities are getting more and more uptight all the time, and it gets to the point where you can't do anything. For instance, if you want to tinker with alternative energy technology, you better not do it in a city, because your neighbors are going to be saying that you're, you know, doing this and that. They have code enforcement officers. Neighborhood associations won't let you do anything. They won't let you hang a clothesline behind your house. So it's getting to the point where the average American who used to have the freedom to tinker in his backyard or his garage or whatever is really in a city environment is being told that you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. America's no longer free like it used to be. And I tell people that free energy won't really happen until we have the freedom to have and use it. And we don't have that right now.
That's an interesting statement. So you feel like the corporate lobby, the government under the corporate influence is restricting people's freedom to benefit from such a thing as free energy?
Well, that's wrapping a whole lot of ideas into one little question. I wouldn't state it like that. I would say there is a conspiracy to hinder the use of free energy.
Yeah, well, I think most people would agree with you. In fact, people who know nothing about free energy technology, in a poll that I've taken from coast to coast in the U.S., have basically agreed with your statement. They may not know what the technology is that's being restricted or sequestered or suppressed, but the average American has a feeling that there are better things that have been developed, that our high technology has come up with answers that we are not giving access to.
Well, that's true. You know, there's been, as far as I know, from my own contacts in this field, there's at least six working prototype free energy machines out there.
Do you want to name them?
No, I don't know who they are. I know one of them. One of them's in Switzerland. It's pretty well widely known about that one.
Oh, yeah. You mean the religious communes?
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's not really a problem of technology. It's obvious people know how to build these things. The problem is political.
Yeah. Well, and
so until we have the freedom, we're not going to have them.
As they say, follow the money. And it's also an issue of power, I believe, because some of these people have enough money. They don't need money anymore. It's more than that.
Yeah, it's gone into paranoia. These people are paranoid. They're absolutely terrified that somebody's going to get loose and have their own energy supply and won't be coughing up a check every month. And so they're terrified that people are going to get loose from their control. That's all it is. Fear.
Well, maybe we can pursue that discussion just a little bit later in the hour. For now, why don't we get back to your story? So you were frustrated over the utility company trying to rip you off for connecting wires to your home on your 40 acres in Colorado.
Yeah, and when they left, you know, I was standing there kind of confused and upset and frustrated and a little bit ticked off, and I was looking at that pole over across the creek bed, and I thought to myself, there's got to be a way to put up an antenna I was thinking like a satellite dish, you know, a parabolic dish, that we could transmit that electricity to this spot. And I had never heard of Tesla at that point. I didn't know anything about any of this stuff. And once I got back to town, I started digging around and looking, and I stumbled on Tesla, and lo and behold, there was this guy, Steve Ellswick, right down the street. So I went over and talked to him, and we drove up to Denver and met Toby Groats, and we started the Tesla Society right there.
So these were two local people who had similar interest in Tesla's work.
Well, Steve Ellswick was the president of the Tesla Society for years, and Toby Groats was actually in Denver. And we met at Toby's house. and
so you have the advantage of having a neighbor who was very knowledgeable about Tesla's work.
Right, right.
Well, what a coincidence.
And, there are no coincidences.
That's a good one. So you, without access to the Internet, you went to the public library and researched this? Is that it?
Yeah. You know, that's what we did in those days. You go to the library, you poke around, you talk to people. Somebody says, well, I know about this Tesla book company in Texas, so I got a hold of them, and I started just poking around, and finally I found my way to Virginia Beach at the Casey Foundation, and it was in there volunteering in the library that I came across Keeley's biography.
Okay, so now we're switching from Tesla, who was born in the, mid-1800s and died in, 1930-something? Now we're John Ernst Worrell Keeley, right? So this is how you came in contact with the man John Keeley, by going to Virginia Beach and intercepting mail from Europe coming in to this foundation?
Right. The phone here is breaking up a little bit. I don't know what your side or my side. While I was volunteering at their library, a couple librarians were in England going through an inheritance that they got. They had inherited the collection, the research collection of Egerton Sykes, who had several newsletters and publications in the 60s. And they were shipping back the books and documents that they wanted to keep in their library, and I was there opening these envelopes. And it was in these envelopes that all this Keeley material showed up.
Interesting. So you had never heard of Keeley before?
Never heard of him.
And now you're getting envelopes of documents that date back 100 years that tell of his work.
Well, they weren't documents 100 years old. They were documents from the 1960s.
I see. Okay.
And, once I found out about Keeley and I found out this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life, I hit out on the road and I went to all the old university libraries within driving distance of Virginia Beach, combed through all these old libraries and old books, looking for anything I could find about John Keeley. And I found quite a bit of stuff.
Interesting. But if the average person were to go to their local library, they wouldn't necessarily find anything, right?
No, they won't. You have to go to the old university libraries that were functioning at that time period. And, the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, they had some stuff. There's a university at Hampton, I forget what it's called, and they had a couple of articles. And I just went to many, many, many libraries. I just went everywhere.
I managed
to find quite a bit of stuff.
You brought up a point that I think needs to be mentioned here about libraries in the United States, and this may very well apply to other countries as well. Libraries are throwing away older books and restocking their shelves with newer ones. I'm not sure that this is how libraries have always, behaved, but it appears that some of the old books that talk about technologies relating to energy are no longer available in public libraries. And you just mentioned that a university library that actually was in existence when these matters took place would still have old volumes on the shelves. Is that it?
Right. Yeah, the old libraries, the old university libraries still maintain the old, well, they did 20 years ago. I don't know what they do now.
Yeah, it could be they've joined the practice of throwing out the old stuff.
Yeah, the standard operating parameter today in the libraries is if somebody doesn't check it out, you throw it out.
Yeah.
And then, so what's happening is they're filling up these, our libraries, our heritage that we created. They're throwing out all these books and replacing them with romance novels.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what happened here at the library that I was using on the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. I went in there recently, and all the science books, they had quite a stack. Considering it was a small satellite library, the entire science section was taken out of there. And as you said, replaced with, they've become more like a video store now than an actual library where you can get something to read.
Well, one of the premier science centers in the United States was the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. That's where Ben Franklin and all these guys, Keeley, and who got together and, as scientists, and they gathered and they exchanged papers and stuff. You go there today, it's a playground for kids running around without control, yelling and screaming. So our heritage is being destroyed.
And at the same time, they're bemoaning the loss of interest in math and science here in the States on the part of school kids. That's sort of an interesting paradox, isn't it?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon. And, you know, a lot of people are creating their own private libraries. Like I have my own private research library. You know, they throw them out, I dig them out of the dumpster.
Yeah, one nice thing about them throwing them out is that they're cheap.
Right.
I've gone to some book sales here that at the local library where they're basically you can fill a bag with these excellent old books for a dollar. You know.
Right, right. And that's one of the reasons I bought this old building, because we can store a lot of that stuff.
Now, speaking of the building, you told me that you have a museum.
We have the start of one, and I've been collecting whatever I can get my hands on over the years, which hasn't been much. But it's intended to be like the old-type museum where you have these things on exhibit and people who are permitted. You know, you don't want kids doing this, but people can actually put their hands on these things and we can work with them instead of just putting them behind glass so nobody can have access. Or worse yet, putting it in the basement storeroom so no one ever even knows it's there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's sort of interesting that I guess it was the Smithsonian had one of the GM EV1s on display until the week that the movie Who Killed the Electric Car came out. And then they pulled that EV1 from public display. And they made some excuse as to why it was necessary to remove it the very week that that movie came out. But I thought that was quite interesting, that the public's interest in that vehicle would have been at its peak that very week, and that's when they took it off display.
Yeah, I met a guy 20-some years ago who was collecting these old antique black box medical devices. And he'd go around the country collecting these, and he traced some to the Smithsonian. And he went all the way across from here, all the way over to there, and they says, well, yeah, but they're in these warehouses, and nobody can go in there because of asbestos, the danger of asbestos. Can you imagine? Three warehouses locked up, nobody can get in them.
And that was as best as they could do, making that excuse.
20-some years ago, and it probably hadn't changed today.
What are you referring to when you say a black box medical device?
In the old days, all these kinds of instruments were built in black boxes. So they kind of picked up that handle, you know. People talk about
instruments meaning?
Just a black box.
I mean, are you referring to some special type, like a Rife-type device, or?
Oh, it's just a manner of speaking, euphemism.
Okay. Okay, well, let's get back to your story then. So you started receiving envelopes from England containing Keeley documents, and you became absorbed in the work of Mr. Keeley.
Right.
So maybe
I set out to learn everything I possibly could about anything that had anything to do with vibration.
Okay, so why don't we back up now and talk about Mr. Keeley. What was his early life, and what led him to get involved in this technology?
I think he was born to it. There's no other way you can explain it. When he was a kid, he was building experimental stuff, and we don't really know a whole lot about his childhood. Somebody said he worked in a circus. Supposedly he was a carpenter in a cabinet shop.
Was it that his father was some kind of musician?
His grandfather.
And he grew up in a church listening to the organ or something?
Well, yeah. You know, Keeley was very gifted. He had perfect pitch, apparently, obviously. And he was an accomplished musician, very creative musician. And he obviously was alert to any kind of sounds and unusual sound, especially musical pitches and whatnot. And I believe that he got his start with understanding his work with chords, which is all important, when he saw windows rattling in the church when certain notes were played, but it didn't rattle when other notes were played. And I think that was one of the big attractions that drew him into the science, was looking in things like that.
So would we say then that Mr. Keeley was one of the first people on record to take note of resonance? not electrical resonance, because that hadn't really been discovered yet, but
I don't think so, because you know, music goes back to ancient Egyptian times.
Yeah, but as far as what we in the Western civilization would acknowledge as having been a first, would we say that at least in the application of resonance to produce energy or a system of doing work, would we say that, I mean, can you mention someone prior to Keeley by name that was also interested in these matters?
There's rumors about a guy named Bessemer or Bessemer or something like that, who supposedly made some kind of machine. I think we could say that Keeley was the first person to have the idea of harnessing sound and vibration for useful purposes other than music instruments.
Right. Okay, because the work of Tesla and others since then, having to do with electrical resonance, wasn't really possible prior to Tesla's time. The provision of electricity to play with just wasn't there, right?
Well, it was at that time that electricity came into its own, when Volt and Ampere and Ohm and all those guys and Faraday, they all came out with their experimental devices. And the big push at that time was to create instrumentation so they could quantify the electric phenomena. And once they did that, then it became engineerable. Then guys like Tesla could show up on stage, and Edison, and they could really build stuff with this now that they could measure it.
Right. So Keeley, because of not having access to the electricity to play with, and he wasn't really, that wasn't his cup of tea. He was into sound.
He wasn't. See, he played a little bit with electricity, but that's not where his interest was. His interest was in discerning the evolutionary forces, the causative forces in nature that made everything work. And there's more to that than just electricity. So he went for the root cause of everything, which is part of the reason people don't understand what he was doing. And he got into the quantum level of the atom, which wasn't even acknowledged to exist. He did this work in the 1870s and 1880s, and I think it was Rutherford who got the credit for declaring the existence of an electron in 1893. So Keeley was working on sub-electron physics before conventional science acknowledged it even existed.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a great deal of mystery surrounding his life story. As you said, we don't really know much about his childhood. There's a lot of rumors and claims of his having been a con artist and this, that, and the other. But we can't deny that the man made observations about sound waves and their effect on matter, and he came up with some deductions and some working systems that, even if half of what we know about him is false, there's still the other half that has to be accounted for.
So, yeah, that's true. You know, there's no denying that the man was brilliant, and he was not only brilliant intellectually, but he was brilliant mechanically and musically and a whole bunch of other things that he did that it was just, you know, if you've ever cut metal and built something out of metal, you've got to admire people like Keeley, who built hundreds and hundreds of machines.
Yeah. Now, that's something that you and I discussed earlier in the week, and that is that you yourself are not an armchair researcher. You have turned many a bolt or nut with wrenches in actually fabricating or replicating devices. And I think that's something good to mention at this point, that many of us are pursuing the intellectual side and the historical side of this, such as I've been up to this past couple of years. And I haven't had a great deal of opportunity to build devices, even though I'm capable of it, and I have done a certain amount of it. But you have now for many, many years been a hands-on type of researcher.
That's true. I felt that if we were going to understand what Keeley was up to and what he was doing, we would have to make the attempt at least to replicate some of his machines, because he made his own instrumentation, he made his own devices, he made everything, because there wasn't any industry out there to support him. Today we can go to Radio Shack or the internet and order anything we want. If we got the money, well, he had to make everything. So we have to do it. We have to get in there and get our hands dirty. We have to, it is not possible to understand the properties of metals and parts for machines unless you hold them in your hand, because they vibrate. And, you know, you can sit there theoretically in your rocking chair, as you say, but you're not going to get that. You're not going to get it, because you've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to hold these pieces.
Okay, so let's get to the point of vibration, because that's what Keeley's work really revolves around. In a nutshell, how would you describe his observation of the natural occurrence of vibration and how it can be manipulated by humans? How would you explain this to someone who knows nothing about science or physics, but who would like to understand what Keeley's work? How could you simplify it?
There are certain forces in nature that are pretty awesome to witness, for instance, tornadoes and hurricanes. And it is my hypothesis and belief that Keeley was trying to harness the natural forces found in nature that even today science hasn't even made an attempt to harness. They just kind of look at them and scribble a bunch of equations to describe the motion they see, whereas Keeley worked very hard to discover the functioning principles behind what we see so that he could replicate a machine that would replicate that motion. So I sometimes tell people that these dynospheres, when they spin, when they're supposed to do what they're supposed to do, it's like having a captured tornado. And that kind of rotary motion is a natural phenomenon. We see it all the time, tornadoes all the time. Last week we had 65 tornadoes go across the country. There's hurricanes every year. Every planet spins, every star spins.
Now, is this getting into a vortex-type technology then?
In that regard, yes. There are vibration and oscillation play a part in rotation. And as Keeley one time made the statement that all motion is vortex motion, which is kind of a tough thing to grasp, because you think, well, you know, a bullet traveling through the air, there's no vortex there unless you count it spin. So there's other things that he was trying to say and trying to do. In those days, you know, they had the old ether theory. And one of the ether theories was that atoms were miniature tornado-type spinning elements.
Isn't that the current consensus?
Well, similar. They do consider the electron spins around a nucleus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's just a theory. And according to, what's his name? The Nobel guy that died recently. He said that the orbiting electron theory is dead. And I agree. I don't believe in orbiting electron theory.
Are they believing that it's more of a vibration rather than an orbit?
Well, I don't know what the current theory is now. I don't know how they currently look at it. I think they're hanging on to the orbiting electron until they can come up with something better, because even as flawed as it is useful. They have found ways to apply what they think they know about it. So we have computers and rockets and whatnot, and they all work. So to push this thing further, which is what Keeley did, he pushed it and pushed it and pushed it until he was able to work in that realm and actually build machines that evidenced all kinds of really neat phenomena like rotation and disassociation of different kinds of things and even levitation.
And this is using sound waves.
Right. Now, not necessarily audible sound waves. You know, there are inaudible sound waves. And just recently, they acknowledged that sound travels through outer space and across the face of the sun and all kinds of places nobody ever expected to see sound before.
Hmm.
So there are aspects of sound that, you know, we have to be aware that when we say the word sound, there's a whole big gamut of different kinds of phenomena that would fall under that word.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned a dynosphere. This was the principal type of device that Keeley built?
Right.
And are these viewable on a web page of yours, or?
Yeah, on my main web page, there's pictures of four of them. And you can click on any of those pictures and see more pictures, or even read what other people
have. Devices that were built by Keeley?
No, these are machines that I have built.
Okay, you have built them. But I understand you also have in your possession a machine that was actually built by him.
No. A friend of mine had one. And the story about that, what happened to it, is on my website also. It got stolen, to make a long story short. Somebody stole it. It's out there hidden someplace. The government tried to steal it from him several years earlier. We don't know who stole it this time. We only presume it's people with, you know, who knows. We don't know who's got it. Somebody's got it, and everybody in this field knows it's stolen material, and so we probably won't see it for quite some time.
Yeah, and did you pattern your devices after that model? Is that it?
No. That machine was Keeley's original Keeley motor. When you hear about the Keeley motor, that's that machine. And it was Keeley's attempt to capture or to create rotation from disassociation of water in various different manners and means. And he gave up on that. And he went to these dinosaurs, which he called globe motors or sphere motors.
Now, a globe would be an appropriate word because it basically looks like a really shiny brass or copper globe, huh?
Yeah, they're brass.
Okay.
And so anyway, he gave up the Keeley motor working on with his ether, which was his disassociated water. And he said, this thing will never work. There's no way we can get this thing to work consistently. And so he went to the sphere motors, the dynamic sphere motion. And the word derives from his model of the molecule, which is a spinning, imagine, if you will, an orange with three skins on it. And each skin rotated 90 degrees to the other two. And that's the way he conceived the atom and the molecule. And he called those dynospheres.
Hmm.
And his dynospheric motors were designed to be fractal functioning units of the molecule.
Now, what caused the rotation of those spheres?
Well, it's an interplay of forces. You know, I'm not trying to beat around the bush here. We don't really understand how and why. We got a lot of hypotheses. We've got a lot of study. I've got thousands of pages of notes and drawings, and I've read many thousands of, you know, research paper, anything I can get my hands on that'll help crack this.
But is the idea that once you get this thing spinning, it continues to spin? Is that it, or?
Well, it requires some of this etheric gas or vapor that we put into it as a working medium, much like a heat pump has a fluid in it as a working medium. So, yeah, once we get the thing rotating, it will function quite strongly. And Keeley had them running. He showed them to scientists and engineers, and he showed them to thousands of people. And he was powering a sawmill with it, and they were putting one in a locomotive. We never did find out what happened to that. And they were real, and they worked.
Now,
so if he can do it, we can do it.
Sure. Now, so in other words, you're able to do work with the outer sphere as it spins? Is that it?
Yeah, the outer sphere, that big brass sphere you're looking at, is attached to a shaft. And as the sphere spins, the shaft spins, and you attach, you know, generators or pumps or whatever to the other end of the shaft.
But it wasn't because of inducing sound waves that the thing started spinning. It was actually a gas.
No, the gas is just a working medium. You've got to have something to work the medium. And it's acoustic fields of different kinds that creates a dynamic atmosphere, if you will, in which this gas starts to pulsate.
through
that pulsation, we'll get a rotary component off that pulsation. We have had them move a little bit. We haven't had rotation, but we have had them move like they wanted to spin. But, you know, they're not right yet. We haven't got it right yet.
Okay, so it's a science that you're perfecting based on his models.
Right.
Now, did he ever patent anything?
Yeah, we found two patents in the patent office not pertaining to any of this. And that's all anybody's found that I know of.
So no one could have ever referenced his work in a patent application because he never patented any of this stuff.
Well, so far as we know, he didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of secrecy in the patent office, too, so we don't really know what's over there.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Well, we know what's happened to inventors in more recent years. People who, like Stan Meyer, for instance, there's been a lot of attempts to discredit his work and that of others as well. And so I can understand that a person like John Keeley would be, you know, listed in the history books or left out of them, as it were, for the same reason that inventors from more recent decades have also been maligned and misrepresented in the newspapers and in the textbooks. They've basically been left out of them. For instance, when I was doing my research on water as a fuel, and I went to the largest library here in Lexington, which is the second largest city in Kentucky, and I found no reference to Stan Meyer in any of the library books on hydrogen and so on, which to me it was an eye-opener. Why is it that a guy that is just 3 hours north of Lexington was in the newspapers, was on television, actually came to Lexington, did a demonstration of his technology and looking for investors, private demonstration, of course, but a number of business people here in town attended that demonstration, and yet the local library makes no mention of even the possibility of turning water into fuel.
Well, I can put some light on that a little bit. See, academia, like, for instance, the university research community, they have a, if you listen to them talk, they have their own culture, and they have their own system all wrapped up. It's almost a closed system. Whereas they'll say, well, we haven't found any reference to Keeley in the literature. But when they say the literature, they mean the peer approved, you know, peer
reviewed, yeah,
and the academic journals, and that's the literature they're talking about. So unless you got a PhD and you got a professorship someplace, you're not going to be mentioning any of the literature. So they're never going to go back and look at any of these references. There are some wildcat scientists, though, who will read outside of the literature, and they'll take what they find and bring it in and then rewrite it and rename it and relabel it and say, look what I discovered.
Yeah, exactly.
And they do that constantly.
Well, it's all about glory for an individual and for a corporation or for an institution or a university.
Yeah, it's about the money and the ego, right?
Yeah. Well, let's see then. We didn't get your website out and what materials you're offering. Why don't we mention, what is your website, your webpage address?
The URL is svpvril.com. And we're devoted to this research. We want to understand the nature of the we want to understand the vibratory nature of the universe, that we could build machines, create processes that will help mankind.
Well, that's great. That's a lofty goal. Now, SVP, V-I-R-L, no space.
V-R-I-L.
V-R-I-L. Does that stand for anything?
Yeah, Vibration Research Institute and Laboratories. It actually was kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke, because a lot of these people get off on this really weird crap, you know. And there was some stuff about the Vril Society of Germany, you know, some kind of metaphysical cult BS. And people were talking about them being evil and everything else, and I just threw that out there just as a, you know, here's a burr on everybody's saddle. If you want to do scientific research, it won't mean anything to you. But if you want to sit there and flap your jaws in an armchair, have at it.
Yeah, so SVP stands for
Sympathetic Vibratory Physics.
Okay, and then V-R-I-L. L stands for?
Vibration Research Institute and Laboratories.
Okay, very good. And if they can't remember that, they could just do a word search on Dale Pond or Keeley, and your site will come up on a Google search or something, won't it?
Yeah, it'll be one or two place.
Okay. And then they can go to that site, and what can they order from you there? Do you have some books?
We have about 400 items in our online catalog. Almost all of them pertain to this field of research, the physics and science of vibration, what people have done, what people can do, the basic science of it. And because when I started this, you couldn't find anything on vibration. I mean, there was a book or two that some physicist wrote someplace, you know, about sound and acoustics, and this thing called music therapy and sound therapy. There was one or two or three or four books available in the early 80s. Now there's hundreds of them. They're all over the place. But when I set out to do this, I found a lot of these old books that Keeley had read himself, because if you want to know what he did, you have to think like he did. And I found those old books, and I'm republishing those. I found a lot of material that applies to this field in one way or another, and we're republishing that. So we're
That's
just
excellent.
Making as much information available as we possibly can.
Now, with 400 items, I would venture to say that you've got one of the most, comprehensive inventories of alternative energy materials as anyone.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's good to hear that you're digging up old reference works and republishing them. I think that's very important.
Yeah, there's a real good reason behind that. Somewhere between 1910 and 1930, you want to talk about conspiracy theories? There was, excuse me, there was an effort to rewrite all the textbooks, believe it or not.
Well, I've heard that Tesla, for instance, was deliberately left out of some school textbooks, like in California.
Yeah, well, they wrote out all the science, too. And this is not me just speaking. They did a congressional research investigation into this. And they found, here's what they found out, that the power companies, which are owned by Morgan and Edison and all those guys, they built these power companies all over the country, and the managers of the power companies were required to get on the school boards, the local school boards. And then they rewrote all these textbooks, and they introduced them into all the schools and got rid of all this old science.
And you have documentation about this?
Yeah, there's a published congressional report on it.
It'd be very, very interesting to, see the evidence of that. I'd be very interested in seeing it. I've been interested in just over the last few months in finding out some of these early acts of suppression. And really, it seems that it's only after people die that you're allowed to talk about the suppression that they were guilty of. While they're still alive, it's a more touchy issue. But after 70, 80 years have passed, it seems easier to start airing the acts of suppression that have taken place, because the characters are all gone.
I don't know. It continues. It's the same people, the same families doing the same stuff.
Yeah.
Did in Keeley's time, same ones. It's like they walk around with immunity and nobody can touch them, and they just do what they want. They trashed our library systems. They've trashed our universities. They've trashed our science research. They're trashing everything.
Well, I will tell you this. My father was a rocket scientist, and he was interested in sound. In fact, when I got in a garage band when I was a teenager, and I asked for his help in hooking up the speakers to my PA system, I didn't know anything about impedance matching. And he revealed to me, even though he was still working, and he'd been working on all kinds of top secret stuff since around World War II, he told me that he had worked with speakers in developing a weapon and using sound as a means of destroying objects. So that was pretty interesting. He didn't delve into it. He's still under probably lifelong obligation to remain quiet about it. But he did tell me that he had been involved in such research. Now, he died a couple years ago, and I just thought I'd do a web search. I typed in his name. He went by the name D.H. Roby. And wouldn't you know that even though he retired before the Internet became popular, some of his research is posted on the Internet from the 50s, dealing with underwater sonars and whatnot, which I thought was quite interesting, because I understand the Navy, even recently, has been getting in trouble because of some high-powered sonar they're doing underwater that's killing whales and whatnot.
Do you know anything about those sonar units?
You know, I don't. And I had an interesting experience. I was flying back from Mexico, from Guatemala, actually, and I was on a plane from Mexico, and I was sitting next to a submarine commander, you know, nuclear sub-commander, and he was real talkative with me up until the point that I mentioned this very point about my dad's research and how I'd heard in the news that they were doing something like that, and he clammed right up and wouldn't talk to me the rest of the flight.
Oh, yeah, they can't.
I must have touched on a sensitive issue there, which I don't know anything about it. All I knew is my dad had told me he'd worked with sound. That was the end of it. And then I'd heard in the news that they were using a sonar to do some kind of whatever, underwater detecting other enemy submarines.
Well, you know, they have the job of protecting our country from, you know, whatever might come over the ocean. So you can't blame them for everything they're doing. That's
no,
their
I
job,
don't.
And they're doing the best thing they can. The particular sonar units that I heard about, they drag this thing behind these ships. They're not submarines. They drag it. Well, they probably do submarines too. But if you go out on a beach like Virginia Beach, you can stand there on a beach and you can, way off on the horizon, you can see these ships go by at regular intervals. Well, those ships are dragging these sonar units through the water to detect submarines and whatnot. And around the Chesapeake Bay entrance is a real important thing to do. And a guy told me that those units were putting out a 1 million watts of sound power.
Wow.
And he said there's so much power in those things that they disintegrate anything in aluminum, like aluminum rivets and things like that, in the ships. So they're putting out a lot of power, and it's one of those trade-offs. Either we protect our shores or... You know, I'm not saying one way or the other. It's just the way it is.
Well, that's right. It's not
with a better system.
It's not anything that we can really get into, and we don't want to. All we want to do is find a way to supply our own energy without getting ripped off and without polluting the planet.
Or getting killed.
Yeah. Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
So...
Don't you want to talk about Keeley's water thing a little bit?
Yeah, that's of great interest. That's the main purpose for which I opened a museum, was talking about water as fuel. And the fact is that after Faraday, Keeley was the next person up, really, to come up with a notable claim about being able to decompose water.
Keeley was trying to do something extraordinary. He, you know, you got to remember, this was pre-electric days, pre-everything days. You know, they were just still in horse and buggy days. And he apparently saw an example of water hammer, because in those days they were beginning to pipe water into the cities, and they were having all kinds of problem with the pipes blowing up due to water hammer. And I believe that he witnessed some of that, and he said, "Wow, look at all that power. We ought to be able to harness that." So one of the functioning principles in the original Keeley motor is water hammer.
Interesting. Well, isn't that what the guy down in Georgia has perfected into a system?
I don't know about that. But anyway, Keeley was trying to make this motor. And through that process of building many different models of it and pushing, he got to where he could, you know, if you draw a vacuum on liquid water real fast, it vaporizes. It's like boiling water. Same phenomena. So he was pulling these vacuums on the water surface, creating this water vapor. And that's what he was calling his etheric vapor. And he was trying to work with that vapor because it's got a lot of very unusual properties. And he was using that in his original motor design as a working fluid inside that thing. And then he kept using that etheric fluid that he developed through all those years, he did get to a point where he says, I don't think we can run a motor on this etheric vapor the way he was doing it. So he stopped doing that motor research. But he kept working with that vapor because it had all these interesting properties. And so we're even using it in the dynospheres because I believe that that vapor is sensitive to thought. Well, I don't think we want to get into that on this conversation. But during the process, he found ways that he could take water and disassociate it slowly or quickly, and he could dissociate it slowly and store it, like that big thing they found under the floor. That was his storage tank for this fluid.
Now, this is something that they claimed was a part of a scam, some hidden compressed air cylinder that was used to actually do the work that was supposedly coming from his devices.
Yeah, but that sphere had 3-foot-thick walls on it. You don't store it. They didn't have PSI in those days to warrant anything like that. Keeley was working so far ahead of his time that, you know, it's hard to even comprehend a man could do what he did.
Yeah.
But
well,
even he,
that.
Basically that thing was under the floor because he didn't need it anymore. He got rid of it. He couldn't get anybody to haul it off, so he just, supposedly, the way the story goes, he levitated it up in the air, and then they put it down in the dirt, and he reversed his switch and pushed it down in the dirt, and they put the floor back over it. He's just trying to get rid of it.
Huh. Interesting. I have in front of me Gene Manning's book from 1996, The Coming Energy Revolution.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've seen it. You're quoted in it. She mentions Keeley's, the controversy surrounding his, I guess especially the motor company, and the fact that a bunch of investors basically wanted to see some profits coming out of Keeley's work, and that was largely responsible for his reputation as a con artist because of their involvement in his activities.
Yeah, if you go back and read all those newspaper articles that occurred during the time of the Keeley Motor Company, it is the most extraordinary story you'll ever read because these people got in there and they just jacked the price of stock around, and they would have Keeley hold demonstrations, which they would widely publicize, and then the next day the stock would shoot up and they would sell it. It was all big manipulating game. And Keeley was stuck there holding the bag.
Yeah, he was sort of caught in the middle.
Yeah.
Well, I know from my contact with people who are tinkering with alternative energy technology around the world, a big problem is that they have no money. I mean, a person has to make a living, and you can't make a living doing this, so therefore you are in a little bit of a vulnerable position if someone offers you money, and you become somewhat their slave, and you have to play by their rules. So you basically, you know, give up your control of what you would like to do with your technology. And in many cases, you end up being put under a non-disclosure agreement where you can't even talk about it anymore. So what you would like to share with mankind, you can't even do that.
Yeah, Schauberger is a prime example of that. He got ripped off. He came over here from Germany, and they bought him out and ruined him. So, you know, we have to look back at these guys like Tesla and his business practices and Keeley and his business experiences, and we have to learn from those people. Otherwise, we're going to get caught in the same trap.
Yeah, and it is a trap. And the people with the money are the ones who basically spring that trap, as far as I can see.
Well, they can. There's good people out there who have money who aren't predatory. You know, they want to help the world. There's a lot of people like that. And you got to have something. You got to be far enough along in your work and your research that it looks viable. That it looks like, because investor wants to know, well, if I put money in this, are we going to achieve a goal, a worthy goal? That's what he wants to know. And if you can't answer that before he writes a check, he's not going to write it.
Yeah, and the ones who have, many of them have been disappointed because a lot of factors are involved in bringing a product to market.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not easy.
I realized that in the case of Stan Meyer. There were investors, return on that investment, but it wasn't because he hadn't already developed viable technologies. It's just crossing that bridge from having a technology, making it into a a product that's actually usable by the public at large.
Yeah, it's one thing to have a bench model, another thing to have something on sale at Walmart.
Yeah.
And that's where he couldn't go. They weren't able to do that. And that's what we have to learn to do. We have to take it to a point where it's ready to go to a factory to spit it out into the Walmart trucks.
Well, mention something that you know of. It doesn't have to be a Keeley-related device. Something that you know of that could be right now mass-produced and marketed, and it would be helping our planet and helping the consumer. What's an energy device that you've seen that could be brought to market now?
Well, the only one I've seen, I haven't seen it myself, my own two eyes, is that thing over in Switzerland. And they're not going to turn it loose to the public yet. But if they ever got to a point to do that, I think that has enough history. They've been running it for 30 years. They ought to know how to be able to put that thing into a package, take it over to China someplace, and have them re-engineer it, and it'll be kicking out the factory in 6 months. I don't know of any in this country personally. I know people in the field who do know about these things, and I don't pry because I don't really need to know. And, you know, it's one of those need-to-know deals. And somebody's going to come out with us when all the conditions are right for it.
But as far as your own experience with Keeley devices, you've never actually seen one perform at its full potential.
Not yet, no.
Have you talked to people who did see the original Keeley motor work?
No, that's over 100 years ago.
I mean the one that ended up stolen, the one that was more recent.
Oh, we had that. When I had my insights into it, I went to visit with the owner of it, and we repaired some leaks that it had and a few gaskets and stuff like that, and we fired this thing up, and it was something to see. It was very, very impressive. It wasn't running on its own power, but it showed that if the timing were properly set and all these other things were properly set, that the thing would probably be so impressive that you could raise money like he did over 100 years ago.
Yeah. Now, are you saying that it was an internal combustion engine when you say timing?
No, it's not internal combustion. There's no fire or explosions or anything of that nature in it. Timing, you know, if you look at water, if you study water hammer, which I have, there's two different kinds, and they're all based upon velocities and valve closing, and timing is a very important factor.
Okay, and it was producing motion. It was using water hammer to produce motion in this motor.
But I stress that it wasn't running under its own forces.
Right, whereas the company in Georgia that's using water hammer, that principle in their device is producing heat. They're producing steam. And it's taking an electric motor, drawing not very many watts to produce steam in excess of what that wattage should be producing.
Oh, it's possible.
I believe
there's a lot of energy out there. And some of these people, I did some calculations when I was working with that motor 15 years ago. I set up a spreadsheet and did some calculations. I figured out the power in that machine would go to infinity in like 8 cycles if the timing were perfectly set and everything was perfect. So there's a lot of power out there. If you got the money to build the machines, that's part of the problem. You know, I got a machine shop. It takes a lot of money to build a model, and you know the first one's not going to be right, so you got to rebuild it. But it takes a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, it's great to hear that someone like yourself is doing the work that you're doing, and I'm sure that there are many people who are as admiring of you as I am and would encourage you to keep your work up and keep us posted on what progress you're making. We only have a minute left. I would like to thank you for having joined us and shared your experiences. Again, your website, which people can access and acquire some of the materials that explain these things in detail, is svpvril.com. And there they can learn much more about sympathetic vibratory physics. So what would you like to say in conclusion? You've got about 20 seconds. Anything you'd like to...
I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak freely about some of this stuff, especially some of the past, so we get some of that straight on record. And also thank you for putting this in a format that will be there for a while so people can find it and hear it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to conclude with that, and I appreciate your being with us.
Thank you, James.
All right. Take care. And join us again next week for another show. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.